This is Howard McConaghy, Archetypal Imagery, in 1993. March 14th,
1993. Winter Series, Seasons of Life. Howard McConaghy will speak this evening on archetypal imagery and the seasoning of life. He is an art therapist, and each stage of life is a season only when it is seasoned with disciplined perception. That is, when we can see the aridity of the desert of our soulless world, the seasoning would be paying meticulous attention to the soul in the things and events of experience, seeing soul in the world.
Airplane magazine has an article about how to make a good speech, but it was just a little bit too late, but it did happen. But it spoke about someone who makes good speeches who started out this way, so I thought, well, I'll use that. So this is the start. Before I give this speech, I have something to say. I thought that was a good one. I have a couple of things to say before I give the speech. One is about the workshops tomorrow morning and afternoon. I hope that a number of you will be interested in attending, bringing your own artworks. We'll talk about how to get involved in doing some drawing, and we'll do some drawing. Then we'll look at the drawings and talk about them and proceed from there. But it should be a rather exciting workshop tomorrow. So I hope that we'll see some of you again there. When I first began thinking about this presentation, which I call the Seasons of Life and Creativity, using the theme for the year and the and creativity as a theme for the month or for, anyway. But it seemed to me that the theme, the Seasons of Life, was too developmental for my taste. In fact, I wrote to your chairperson at that time, who was Kate Millard. I said, I don't know how to incorporate the seasons of life into this lecture on creativity, except that each stage of life is a season only when it is seasoned with disciplined perception. Then I said, aesthesis, a Greek word from which we get aesthetics, meant sense perception. Didn't necessarily mean beauty or, it just meant sense perception. But if it's a true perception, then it's beautiful. And that's one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight. So I said that the seasons of life, a stage of life, are only a season when, if it is seasoned with disciplined perception, that is, when we can see the aridity of our of the desert of our soulless world. You know, the poet Wallace Stevens said, "The lion roars at the enraging desert," and I'm not much of a lion. I don't know how loud I can roar, but my whole attempt here is to really roar at this arid, soulless world that we're living in. To sort of season the talk a little bit, I have a number of slides. And there'll be quite a few slides, and they won't be on the screen for too long at a time. They're really meant just to sort of give some life and meaning to the words. So I hope that they don't interfere with the words I have to say. But since writing that letter in which I said I didn't know how to incorporate seasons, but I did say that I would use James Hillman's ideas about creativity, I have realized a connection between creativity and the stages of a human life. Hillman, in his book, The Myth of Analysis, outlines seven notions of creativity, including, well, now I guess we should probably have the lights out so that we can have slides. And I'll just say next, I guess, every time on the slide. That's fine, probably like that. But the backlights are still on. So the seven stages include novelty or newness, in the slide, next slide, which is the season of the childhood. The Promethean thievery and trickery, which is the next slide. It's okay to leave the black light on. Like that, that's fine, yeah. The Promethean or Kouros, or the Persephone, next slide, or Kore. Nature and renewal is another side, next slide. The cyclical and nurturing adult season of mothers and mother and nature. Oh, you move too fast now. But this, okay, the next one is the method and structure are the Senex. That's who this is. Senex, season of the old wise person. However, these seasons are not linear in psychology and creativity as they may be biologically. Archetypes are eternal. They live in the past and the future and always side by side in everyday life and human activity. Today we are living in a special season. Jung said we are living in what the Greeks called the kairos, the right moment for a metamorphosis of the gods, of the fundamental principles and symbols. We are living in an age of transition, in other words. The philosopher and aesthetician John F.A. Taylor claims that in every domain of human activity, the sense of human community is capable of recession. Next slide. In our day, it recedes, he says. In such a season, there can be no act so indispensable as to recall that there are consistencies in every domain which novelty may blur, but is forbidden to repeal. And Hillman concludes that to have no real contact with the forces that are shaping the future would be to fail the kairos of transition. So we want to take a psychological view of the idea of seasons. We may think of seasons as a natural division, as the four seasons or the seasons of human life. But the dictionary tells us that the word season may also mean at the right moment, the kairos. In season, it may mean, or in heat, as with the animals, passion. And there is that second meaning of season, to add zest or piquancy, add the spirit to life. This second meaning contains also the connotation to cure, as in drying wood to prepare it for use, or to cure a hide to make leather. I think that this second meaning, with this meaning, we are more nearly coming to terms with the kairos. I think that this to season also includes the idea of to render competent through experience, to cure the greenhorn. And next slide, to sow or plant seed. We get the word semen from the same root. Finally, to season can mean to disseminate. Our word seminary comes from this root. To savor something is to taste it or perceive it fully. There are no seasons unless we perceive them. If taste is perception, savory can also be related to savant, the wise, or to be wise or sage. In addition, we get discernment and sensibility from the same root, as well as a well-seasoned act of creativity. Now, the Greek word aesthesis, as I said, means sense perception. As Henry Corbin writes, beauty is that great category which specifically refers to the Deus Revelatus, the supreme theophany, divine self-revelation. The gods are given in creativity, and their beauty lies in creative perception. As Hillman says, all things, as they display their innate nature, present, next, Aphrodite's goldenness. This is Aphrodite's being born, being pulled from the sea. They shine forth, he goes on, and as such, they are aesthetic. Creativity, then, is perception, paying close attention to the soul in all things, the soul in the world, as Hillman would say, in ordinary, all things in ordinary events and experiences. But our notions of creativity are multiple. One notion of creativity is novelty. This notion is filled with hope and optimism, growth and joy. Hillman tells us that in this notion, creativity demands originality, flux, flexibility, and inspiration. He calls it mercurial novelty involving play, luck, tricks, and he relates it to the puer aeternus and the archetype of the divine child, next please, which is the first season of human life. And of course, to Hermes, next please, our search for the various meanings of the word season, in fact, is a hermeneutic act, a play with words, a way of finding a new season, of seasoning our thinking. What I will relate to the adolescent season of life, Hillman attributes to the shadow, next please. Under the aegis of the shadow, he says, the creative becomes contaminated with activity, primitive levels of aggression, and with sexuality. Phallus becomes a potent penis. Next, please. The darkness of the creative urge is irrational, is demanded to achieve the primal power. Raw power, next please, and dismemberment demand a revolt against cultural canons, standards of taste, and morality. As the source of this dynamic vitality is in the dark, it is an invocation of the occult, and it demands a descent into the abyss of disorder, even through derangement of the senses, drugs, drink, perversions. The corollary notion is that creativity lives best at the destructive frontier, close to evil, crime, and death. Next, please. We see the shadow here, and we see Persephone, dark goddess of the underworld. This is Persephone and her mother. On this side is Demeter, and Tripolinus, I believe, is with them. And I shall place Hillman's Prometheus notion of creativity in the life season of adolescence also. Through fire, next please. Hillman writes, man, through fire man can invent and discover. He can convert nature's mystery into a problem to solve, thereby extending the realm of conscious control. The creative, as perceived by the ego, is inventive problem solving. Anything instrumental to the extension or enhancement of consciousness. This is a utilitarian view of creativity. Creating through the ego is necessary, and yet it is a theft, a sin, a Luciferian fall. The human season of adulthood may be seen in the mother, next please, the mother archetype, and the notion of creativity as renewal with the path of cyclical regression. Creativity related to nature, earth, womb, to the transforming ideas, to the transforming seas, next please. Here, creativity comes from the unconscious, nourishing and regenerating and subject to periodic barrenness, like the seasons, Hillman says. Creativity is given to the chosen few, only the talented. This is one view of creativity. It is this nurturing aspect which may be the origin of the idea of art as therapy. But as we shall see, art therapy must acknowledge all the notions of creativity and beauty or aesthetics. Still another notion of creativity which relates to adulthood is identified with eminence, success, fame. Here, Hillman presents the archetype of the persona. Next, please. A representation collective. He says, the individual who wears the mask, next please, can no longer put it down because the mask itself has become the psychic carrier of the instinct, sometimes sacrificing the person in suicide and personal tragedy, next please, for the sake of the personality image which the public requires someone to carry for it. The role carries its creative effectiveness. When the persona absorbs the creative instinct, all the quirks, please, next, all the quirks and facets of a life become symbols. The creative person, as shaper of collective consciousness, as an actor in the historical drama. The Bible begins with a parental notion of creativity. Next, please. God created heaven and earth. He separates, differentiates, and forms. And Hillman points out, he declares his work good. There is only one God, only one right form, one truth. I would relate this notion to the archetype of the Cynex, or old wise person, season of human life. The moral and aesthetic orders are joined. Next, please. Justice, proportion, fitness, system, everything in its own place. The negative side of the Cynics is rigidity and dogma. Finally, a seventh notion of creativity emphasizes imagination, sensuality, incubation, next, please, even pregnancy and birth. The creative person is receptive, sensitive, moody, proceeding on whim and feeling, in the service of the muse or of Aphrodite. This is psyche, next please, or anima archetype. Hillman indicates that anima is the way to psyche, and that anima experiences are an initiatory way for psychological creativity. At the beginning of the process, the anima is psyche itself, still symptomatic, still labile, and unknown. And at the core of every anima fascination is the irresistible beauty of that most beautiful of all created forms, Psyche. Next, please. Thus, anima becomes Psyche through love, and it is Eros which energizes Psyche. With this notion of creativity, we see the creativity as the achievement of love. Hillman says it is marked by imagination and beauty, and by a connection to tradition as a living force, and to nature as a living body. Next, please. He insists that nothing can create without love. This is Psyche stringing his bow. Nothing can create without love, and that love shows itself as the origin and principle of all things. Following the signals of beauty and ugliness is an aphroditic mode of imagining individuation. Next, please. Which maintains Psyche in Aphrodite's temple all the while we go through the world making soul. That's Aphrodite, of course. Hillman would keep Psyche in the service of beauty. And I would note that therapy comes from a root which means to serve. Thus, art, the arts, are archetypally therapeutic. They season our lives, curing our incompetencies by helping us to perceive the soul in the world. So my whole point and the point of the workshop tomorrow is going to be that through some kind of love of the world, love of experience, love of life, we can create that beauty. You don't have to go to art school to get it, to learn how to do it. The ascetic sense perceives the form of things, according to Hillman, apprehending the particular shape of each event, the shape of an event. You know, think about it. Can you draw the shape of an event? Its nature disclosed in its face. I should tell you that I came to art therapy through art education. Next, please. And here I need to differentiate between art education and the education of artists. An art educator is concerned with the art of children and laymen and recognizes the possibility of artistic achievement choosing in their work. On the other hand, those who would educate professional artists must be selective, choosing students who are deemed to have special talent or ability. It is probably true that not everyone can become an artistic genius. Next, please. But if aesthetic activity consists in perceiving the form of things, apprehending the particular shape of each event, then surely everyone can act aesthetically and can produce works of aesthetic merit. In my discovery of archetypal psychology, Hillman's Jungian approach, it was this that first confirmed my concept of art education, which was the concept that I've just been giving you. And then it led to my involvement in art therapy. Archetypal psychology is situated within the artistic culture and history of ideas, arising as they do from the imagination. In addition to Hillman's understanding of aesthetics and beauty, I was drawn to his psychology by his concern to do away with professionalism. I knew that it does not require a professional artist to perceive the form of things next. Rather, it takes careful training of the senses, a sensibility to everyday events. This is what I intended by differentiating art education and the education of artists. In the Myth of Analysis, Hillman wrote, moving psyche into life means moving it not from its sickness, but from its sick view of itself as being in need of professional care and knowledge and professional love. We confusedly believe, he declares, that everyone needs professional therapy as if that is where soul could be found. And I want to echo this idea by insisting that it is a confusion to believe that everyone needs professional art training to produce works of aesthetic merit. We must press beyond our usual ideas of beauty that have held the imagination captive to heavenly notions only, sweetness and light, and away from the world of sense in which Aphrodite was always imminent. Next, please. Neither psyche nor art need our professional care and knowledge. The contemporary art critic, Harold Rosenberg, maintains that today, art consists of one-person creeds, one-person cultures. Next, please. Art's direction, he says, is toward a society in which the experience of each will be the ground of a unique, inimitable form. In short, a society in which everyone will be an artist. Art in our time can have no other aim, no other social aim, an aim dreamed of by modernist poets from Lautréamont, Whitman, Joyce, and the Surrealists, and in which is embodied the essence of the continuing revolt against domination. Here we see the puer revolting against the synax. The domination Rosenberg is talking about is the idea of perfection. Next, please. The academic ideal of harmony and professional training. In a similar gesture, art education has, from the beginning, maintained that it is important for everybody to give visual form to their individual experience through the process of artistic activity. Next, please. And that everybody can get in touch with the object and event in their lives by means of the visual arts. That such activity is aesthetic, that it serves the psyche through image and metaphor, and that to neglect this realm of contact is demeaning to the psyche and it blocks one's individuation. This, by the way, is painted by a Native American young woman in teacher education who had no art experience whatsoever. Next, please. Franz Žižek first demonstrated both the aesthetic and psychological advantage of releasing the creative impulse which is present in all children. He was a contemporary of Freud's in Vienna and started the first art classes for children ever. 25 years later, next please, Marion Richardson in England emphasized the importance of children getting in touch with the psychic image. Mind pictures, she called them. Approximately 25 years again, Henry Schaefer Simran, next please, defined the process of giving form to experience as visual conceiving. As early as 1948, he used the term visual thinking. And then somewhat later, in 1962, Shauna Robertson, next please, illustrated the importance of archetypal themes in motivating children's psyches to creative expression. Excuse me. Excuse me. The theme here was caves. This trend in art education has always emphasized the aesthetic aspect of children's creative activity. It is based upon a psychology of beauty and imagination. Next. Hillman tells us a psychology that does not start in aesthetics, as Psyche's tale begins in beauty, and as Aphrodite is the psyche tu cosmu, the soul in all things. Such a psychology cannot claim to be truly psychology, since it omits the essential trait in the soul's nature. Psyche's essential trait, of course, is beauty. And we have seen that beauty, as the soul's essential nature, does not necessarily mean pretty or soothing. It is beauty in the sense that the soul shines forth in all things. Archetypal psychology holds that the true iconoclast is the image itself, which explodes allegorical meanings, releasing startling new insights. Next. And the most distressing images in dreams and fantasies or in works of art are those which we shy away from, for their disgusting distortion and perversion are precisely the ones that break the allegorical frame of what we think we know about this person or that, this trait in ourselves or that. Next. The worst images are the best, for they are the ones that restore a figure to its pristine power as a numinous person at work in the soul. The image as a numinous person at work in the soul. Many psychologists use drawings and paintings of their patients, as Jung did, with no concern for their aesthetic form or value. They consider the literal content of the work in order to diagnose the patient's so-called problem. This is because they consider aesthetics to be a field of academic philosophy, not simply the creative perception of everyone, of everyday things and events. Next. On the other hand, we can assert that art is therapeutic only when the artist sees the luster of each particular event, its clarity, its particular brightness, that particular things appear at all and in the form in which they do appear. We recognize that part in each work which we did not intend, but which nonetheless is present in the work. Rosenberg suggests that modern artists do pay attention to intuition and psyche. In the front ranks of our researches into the mysteries of self-understanding, he says, stands the artist, the professional of inspiration, who proves himself that by the material evidence of his capacity to see and create. His trade, Rosenberg says, goes back to the oracles and soothsayers of ancient civilizations. Russell Lockhart informs us that the soothsayer is a teller of sooth, not a teller of soothing, but of sooth, that is, things of truth and reality. And Lockhart goes on, in early Rome, there were two great categories of priests, the pontifices and the augures. those who were members of the Collegium Pontificum would issue proclamations, pronouncements, interpretations, and explanations, and otherwise carry out the official duties of the state religion. Next, please. Our word pontificate, in its full range of meaning, relates to this order with its emphasis on authority, dogma, tradition, and orthodoxy. Let's try the next slide. This is the one I would call pontificum, because it's very academic. It's also by a student in teacher education, but one who had learned rules of color harmony and design and so on. And so it makes a rather hollow but academically correct kind of thing. There were, though, then those... Lockhart goes on, those who were members of the Collegium Augurium had the specific task of making known the future by observing the heavens, the flights, calls, and behavior of birds, visions, and dreams. Next. The appearance of various animals and any unusual occurrences, they noted. The latter being of the type we would nowadays call synchronistic events. The augures would observe things carefully. See how they have become aesthetic, because aesthetics is observing things carefully. Whether these were met with accidentally or specifically watched for, they were to make known to those in power whether the gods approved of what was planned or about to be set in motion. The augures could only advise. They had no power. And the poet David White, who, by the way, lives on Whidbey Island, agrees. He says, the poetic tradition would say that the imagination makes presence known to the world, and that the imagination is a form of paying attention to the world. The only question is not whether it is joy or grief you're experiencing, but can you tell the story so well that the story is magnificent and therefore is worth going on? If you tell the story to such an extent that you understand its magnificence, and in paying attention, the attention turns to praise at a certain crucial point, then your part in it, which is unknown in some ways, becomes magnificent in itself. I think that's the heart of art therapy. Thus, aesthetics is a form of perception, of paying attention, and of responding magnificently. White suggests that when you pay attention to the world pays attention back to you, but that the vehicle that began the attention to the world is not commensurate with the immensity which comes back. Paying attention to the world involves our capacity for self-compassion, he says, because when that attention comes back, it wants to know who is there next. The self-presentation of the things of the world calls for our self-presentation. Who is there? The self-presentation, in the face of the immensity which comes back, we are ashamed of what our self-presentation shows. When our client produces distorted pictures, they feel guilty. Next, please. Next, please. And as Hillman says, points out, guilt belongs to the experience of deviation. Well, you went too far, I think. Back up one. No, you didn't go far enough then. Let's go two. There we are. guilt belongs to the experience of a deviation, to the sense of being off, failing, missing the mark. They are still dominated by the academic, these people are still dominated by the academic idea of perfection, translated as realistic perspection and proportion, perspective and proportion, harmony and sweetness, where the most, where the moral and aesthetic orders are joined, justice, proportion, fitness, system, everything in its own place. Next, please. So this guilt and shame, there's a Navajo poet who chants, I'm ashamed before the earth, I'm ashamed before heaven, I'm ashamed before dawn, I'm ashamed before evening twilight, I'm ashamed before blue skies, I'm ashamed before darkness, I'm ashamed before the sun, I'm ashamed before the standing within me which speaks to me. Some of these things are always watching me. I am never out of sight. Therefore, I must tell the truth. That is why I always tell the truth. I hold my word close to my breast. We must not be too literal about this guilt and shame, calling such failings false which need to be set right. To be individual means to be peculiar, to be peculiarly what one is, with one's own odd patterns of archetypal response. To think of one's picture as wrong when it fails to achieve classical Renaissance standards of beauty is to limit one's concept of aesthetics and creativity. This is to assign art to the negative synex. Another poet, Mary Oliver, puts it well in her poem, The Wild Geese. Next, please. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting, she says. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I'll tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscape, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Next. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. Calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. That's a wonderful poem. Follow academic rules of representation or design principles. Next, please. You do not have to walk on your knees. You do not have to learn perspective, proportion, or the color wheel. Next, please. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. It is an animal sense of imagination, not a rational science of representation or composition. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, that is, no matter how individual, unique, peculiar, the world offers itself to your imagination. The world offers itself and to the imagination. Reason, on the other hand, goes out to grasp the world. The world calls to you, over and over, harsh and exciting, announcing your place in the family of things. The family of things. Returning soul to the world requires the acceptance of your place among things. This is an anti-humanist move which opposes the hubris of an inflated opinion of humankind as standing at the apex of the pyramid of existence. It claims that, I claim, that the visual arts have a uniquely important role in the realm of imagination. Next, please. We can talk about imagination of all kinds and in all circumstances, but it seems to me what I'm trying to say as an art therapist and what I believe very firmly is that the visual arts have a particular role, and unique. When I saw the prehistoric cave paintings, next please, in Altamira, I wondered what speech was available to these men. What was music like at that time, and dance? Was art more complex than these? Carl Gustav Karus suggested that thinking in shapes precedes thinking in concepts. He spoke of the psychic force which, he says, absolutely dominates and pervades matter. It creates while still completely absorbed in itself, as if dreaming or thinking in shapes, because it cannot yet think in concepts. Visual thinking. I'm interested in images, and I realize that all images are not visual. I recognize the monumental impact of Hillman's words and ideas. Yet when Hillman speaks of the psyche, he provokes visual images. Quote, "The psyche uses many languages," he says, "in describing itself. We see these best in dreams because they are the best model for the actual structure of the psyche." I would emphasize that dreams are experienced most often as visual more than they are experienced as audible, aromatic, or physical. And Hillman continues to say also that dreams tell us the soul's tales in persons, and that they also use animals, landscapes, parts of the body, and the family. Next, please. Brother, father, son, or pathologized figures such as the idiot boy, the boy with infantile paralysis. Next, please. The figure with queer psychic eyes or on the operating table having her womb cut out. These are all pictorial or visual images. And Hillman emphasizes that the psyche can be seen on the face of all objects. Next, please. In 1985, I suggested that while poetry, music, and dance each has its own muse or muses, the visual arts spring from an earlier source. There's no muse of the visual arts. Noting that Otto, W.F. Otto, says that the nymphs were preformations of the muses, I traced a parallel between modern art and Pan. Next, please. Pan, who loved and chased the nymphs. I related modern art to the passion of Pan and Euphemia, the nymph who, as wet nurse, nourished the muses. This suggested to me that the visual arts may be more primordial, prior to the other arts, giving them succor and life. Modern art is more earthy, intuitive. Goethe, next please. More pathological, immediate, and pervasive, and thus more Pan-like. Hillman shows us that the soul produces crazed patterns, perversions, and decay. Next, please. That they are psychological and archetypal, and therefore they cannot be avoided or worked through. Through a pathological experience, he says, I am bound to the archetype, to an archetypal person who wants something from me and to whom I owe remembrance. That's what we owe the gods. That's where therapy comes into. Yes. Hillman shows us that the soul produces crazed patterns, perversions, and decay, that they are psychological and archetypal, and therefore cannot be avoided or worked through. Through a pathological experience, I am bound to an archetypal person who wants something from me and to whom I owe remembrance. Pathologizing touches our sense of life. It both vitiates and vitalizes, a quickening through distortion. We assume that something for the psyche's survival, its very life and death, is being expressed in this manner and cannot be expressed with the same subtle and vital impact in any other way. And we believe, Hillman says, that the tale told in the image is not even about us, men and women, not about human beings mainly, but about psychic being. Next, please. So that the deformation of human images with maimings, breaks, and superations decomposes our humanistic icon and our spiritual vision, a vision of the perfectibility of man, cracks all normative images, presenting instead a psychological fantasy of man to which neither naturalism nor spiritualism can apply. Both spiritual man and natural man are transformed by being deformed into psychological man. Psychological man is imaginal man. And as David White has told us, the imagination makes the presence known to the world. Psychological man pays close attention to the world. Next, please. And as Hillman insists, this attention is an aesthetic attention, a creative attention, which is archetypal. It is more than personal, more than human. And when you pay attention to the images of the world pays attention back to you in all its magnificence, asking, who is there? Next, please. The work of art tells who is there. Objective psyche is presented in the work, incarnated into the world. Maria Rainer Rilke, the poet, realized that it was not he who controlled the imagination. He wrote, next please, I am the rest between two notes. I am the rest between two notes that are somehow always in discord because death's note wants to climb over. And in the dark, eternal, reconciled, they stay there trembling. And the song goes on. Beautiful. Thank you. Five of my own slides of my own work, which we'll look at afterward for those who are interested to see. Not because they're great works of art and you need to see them, but because you may want to know what does he really know about art? What can he do himself? But I'll entertain any kind of questions now. Yes?
Bring back the question after it's asked.
Yes, sorry, yes.
Could you talk a little bit about
talk a little bit about the practical aspects of art therapy and what you actually do. Art and therapy aren't so awfully practical. An archetypal approach to art therapy, of course, takes very seriously, Hillman's archetypal approach takes very seriously the roots of the meaning psychotherapy, which means psyche and therapy, care or concern. So we're archetypal psychology and archetypal art therapy are concerned with care of the soul much more than care of the individual person. So that, you know, we're not there to cure in the sense of getting rid of, as one of the quotations from Hillman said, you know, that is, there's a person there, a God, who wants something from me and whom I must remember, give some remembrance to. It's to cure more in the way of bringing into fullness, as to cure wood for use or curing leather. That's why I use those examples. Tomorrow's workshop will give you some pretty clear idea of what I do. And of course, every art therapist works differently from every other. Our program is the only archetypal art therapy program based on Hillman's psychology in the world, at the program at the University of New Mexico. I'm now retired from that program, but I was the founder and director for many years. We try to get in touch with where the client is at a certain time, and one way of getting in touch with that is to draw a picture. You know, so, very often a picture will have what I said in the talk also, that we're concerned with what's in the picture that you didn't intend, more than with what you did intend. That's ego knows what it wants to do. But in spite of what ego wants to do and does, psyche puts something in there too. So that we, through paying attention to the world and where we are, we draw a picture of some sort. And then we may talk about it. It may inspire the reading of a poem or a fairy tale. If art therapy really is what it says, art therapy, the art is the therapeutic aspect. Sometimes a client may come for 3 or 4 sessions and just do work and may not say anything about it. Sometimes we do talk about it, related to what is going on in the psyche. That's not very concrete yet. One of the things, I think that very often the first drawing that a client does is not of the aesthetic. You know, I don't think that every scribble that a person puts down is aesthetic, but we help them get in by things similar to what I talked about tonight. We help them get in touch with, in closer touch with the image. The first picture, what is this image? And then very often, as I will do tomorrow in the second part of the workshop, we've done the picture, we talk about the image, what is there. And then I say, now can get even more closely involved with that image, make a more intense representation of the image, do another picture on the same theme. And very often in this day and age, many people say, well, if you insist, but I don't want to do it, you know, or think that at least. But when they have done it, 99 times out of 100, they say, I didn't want to, but it has made me, made a difference. It has gotten me closer in touch with something. And sometimes we go on and on and on, depending on the individual situation. But I never diagnose or never interpret a picture as saying, oh, this means you're schizophrenic or this kind of thing. Does that help? Anything else? Yes?
I was intrigued as you mentioned that there was no muse to the visual arts.
Yeah.
Well,
as an artist, of course, as a young man, I was just going to be an artist, the second Picasso, you know. And so I've always been interested in art, and I always felt kind of cheated that they talk about the muses, and there are nine muses, you know. My wife did a mural of nine muses recently. And there's several muses of lyric poetry and dramatic poetry and history and dance and so on, and no muse of the visual arts, the painting and sculpture. And that always bothered me. So I started thinking about, well, what does this mean? And particularly when I went to northern Spain, to the caves at Altamira. I'm sorry that picture was from the French cave, but because I lost the slide that I had from Altamira, not that I took myself. And I began wondering, you know, what a wonderful art they had, and certainly their speech and music must not have been quite that something or another, I don't want to say advanced, complicated or rich. And then when I ran across Karas' book, I don't know how to pronounce this, C-A-R-U-S, Karas, thank you, which is just called Psyche, in which he says that psyche, in nature itself, in just material, psyche gives form as if speaking or thinking in shape, because she cannot yet think in concepts. This all made me think, well, there may be then very well something more primordial. And then in reading about Euphemia as the mother, as the, not the mother, but the wet nurse of the muses, and Pan's mate, one of his mates, making things related, Pan and Euphemia, the mother of the muses, were to this pre-formation. So it was just, it's something that I've just sort of pulled out from these ideas of that art must be more important or something, but it seems to make some sort of sense, and I haven't gone much further with it than that. Anything else? Yes. I didn't hear all of that.
You were talking about, you said something earlier about taking care of the soul as opposed to the individual person.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that.
I elaborate on the idea of taking care of the soul rather than the individual person or the person. It comes from a careful reading of the root meaning of psychotherapy, which is soul care. Also from the whole archetypal approach, the archetypes are not personal. You know? It's not my Aphrodite. Or when I'm doing art, I'm not I have no claim on Aphrodite. She has a claim on me. So So my artwork is as much hers as mine, let's say. So that many people complain about human psychology as being impersonal, but it can't be archetypal and personal, because the archetypes are more than, greater than, eternal. And the person is, you know, I've got 73 years now, you know, but I don't expect to have more than 15 more at the most. But Aphrodite will go on, and so will Hermes, and all the archetypes are before us and in us and after us. So that if I'm really concerned with the psychology or psychotherapy, and then I'm concerned with knowledge or care for the soul, which is bigger than any of us, you see. It's not my soul, you know. This is my soul, that's your soul. And the other thing, and your soul's different from mine, you know. It's the soul which is involved with all of us and the things of the world. You know, Hillman's concern is the soul of the world and the soul in things. Yes, Kate. So it's more powerful. It's like the paying attention to the world. The world pays attention back in a much more immense way. And so the getting in touch with the archetype comes back to the individual, but in a much magnified way. Whereas the vice versa, it doesn't happen. When you're working with the individual, it doesn't make the archetype bigger. Yes, sir. Yes, John Sanford said a couple of years ago, I heard Sanford say, therapy is it again? Rendering service to the gods. Remembering, because remember that Hermes, the two-day-old baby Hermes, gets out of his crib and traipses out to steal his brother Apollo's cattle. But first he finds this tortoise, and makes a lyre out of the tortoise shell. But he goes on and steals his brother's cattle, comes back in and gets in his crib, and here comes Apollo and says, "You stole my cattle." "Who, me? I'm just a baby, 2 years old. I couldn't do anything like that." So Apollo gets mad and takes him up to Zeus and says, "This youngster stole my cattle." And Hermes did that again, you see. But I mean, there's that whole hermetic play. Remembering the gods is doing a service to them. But my point was then, when he stole the cattle, he drove them off and hid them, and sacrificed one, not to this god or that, but to all the gods. He remembered the gods. And remember when Demeter was so upset because Persephone was abducted by Hades and taken down to... she said, Demeter, of course, is the mother of nature and so on. She says, nothing will grow. There will be no more reproduction of anything. People, crops, grass, birds, anything. And finally, it got so bad because she could do that, that the other gods went to her, to Zeus, and said, there will be no more people to sacrifice to us, to remember us, to do service to us. See, that's the important thing, is service to the gods that builds, that makes psyche. Hillman's term is to make psyche. To keep psyche going, to keep the gods alive, we have to do service to them. Yes, ma'am.
Not exactly.
Sorry. Uh-huh. And arts do that. I'm not so happy with the term exaggeration as with intensification, because exaggeration sounds melodramatic rather than dramatic to me. Because intensification is getting in touch with the immensity of the world that answers back. See, Mary Oliver said the world offers itself not to you. Didn't say the world offers itself to your imagination. That's what the world offers itself. And it offers itself, and it's so magnanimous in that sense that already there's an intensified sort of, you know, including you. And then when you pay close attention, that's when you can see the soul in the world. You can see the beauty of an ugly thing. You know, because there is soul in everything. Every god has its opposite. You know, and who does Aphrodite fool around with? Mars, the god of war. Here's love and beauty, the goddess of love and beauty. And her consort is Mars. You know, because they need each other. They're opposites. So we could say, in a sense, we could say war is beautiful. It's archetypally, they go together. Yes? Not exactly. The Kore is the young girl, the adolescent girl, or just in her late adolescence, and the Kuros is the young man. So that there were I was saying that the if there is a Persephone and Shadow as one archetypal notion of creativity, and I use those seven notions from Hillman's myth of analysis. Then the shadow, or the underworld, or Persephone, is also an adolescent. I use those two sort of together as two aspects of one stage of life among the seven notions of creativity. Does that help them there? So, there's a difference. One is the sort of the hero and revolutionary, as in Prometheus, who I represent as a Kuros, and the other is the shadow, darker. You know, Persephone. Is beautiful also, but she's the queen of the underworld. She's the daughter of Demeter, and she comes up to be with Demeter after the settlement 2/3 of the year and brings ring and flowers and all that kind of stuff. But 1/3 of the year, she's the queen of the underworld, and she's very often then depicted as a dark... fierce, negative kind of character, such as Bella. But then, and that kind of turmoil and shadow and heroic expectations and thieving and wanting to do good and even do bad in order for a good end. And so it's very adolescent. So I was relating those to the if we're saying there are four stages or five stages of life, childhood, adolescence, we're brought in both adolescence, adulthood, we use the mother there, but the father would also work, and then the old age, which would be the synax. because the whole Promethean notion that Hillman talks about is very similar to adolescence. So the Kuros is an adolescent young man, or just at the break between adolescence and maturity, as the Kore is in womanhood. It's through that notion of creativity. Yeah, I mean, Hillman doesn't talk about the Kuros there in Prometheus, but I did that because I was trying to find keep the one series all Greek gods and goddesses. Yeah, good. Sure. Anything else? Yes, sir. Our program is merely an art therapy program because we don't have qualified teachers. It was founded in an art education department, and we don't have any dance and music people there. We tried to get the music department and art department and dance department involved, and it didn't work out, so we said, well, we'll do our own. Yes, I think that I'm not awfully aware of any direct focus on the archetypal from the other expressive therapies, but I'm aware of the possibility of it in all of the therapies. And as you see, I use a lot of poetry. If I could, I would use music in particular. But I think movement and dance are even maybe more vital because you're using the body even more. Are you in another expressive modality? Or? So I haven't gone as deeply into that as I would like, and maybe it's not worth going much further into it than that, but it's something at least worth thinking about, I think. Yeah, good. Thank you for that. Anything else? Anyone else? Yes? Yes. Do you know Hillman's book, The Myth of Analysis? That's a good one, yeah. First part is psychological creativity. Second part is psychological language. So you'd find that interesting. There's also another book by Paul Kugler called Archetypal Language and Archetype, which is a very interesting book. It was part of his doctoral dissertation in a doctorate in languages. Anything else? Yes, sir.
Do you happen to remember the certain anthology that was formed by Mary Oliver?
I have that back in the room. I don't remember the name of the book. It was a book of poems, all by Mary Oliver. I'll have it with me tomorrow. If anyone's going to be here there, if you know anyone who's going to be there.
It sounds like it's available.
It is available, yeah. It may be out of print, I don't know that. But she has a number of books, but I'll have the title of that with me tomorrow. I thought I had it here tonight, but don't. Anything else? And if it's a wonderful poem, isn't it?
Yeah.
You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. But you see, there again, it's eros. There's no beauty without love. So that this, to come back to your question about the immensity comes from love. You know, when you fall in love with a man, He's 10 feet tall. And it isn't that you just think he's 10 feet tall. He is. You know, Marie-Louise von Franz says, when she was 19, she first heard Jung talk. He was talking about a client who saw something happened on the moon or something. And so she went to him after the lecture in the discussion like this and said, well, he wasn't really, there wasn't really a person on the moon. And Jung said there was. Yes? Oh, all right, whatever it was, yeah. Yeah, good, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Good, yeah. Okay, anything else? Do you want to see a couple of my things? Did you want the stickers in there? So where did we put yours? I can't walk over there. Do you have yours or do I? Evelyn? Huh? Well, all right. All right, now go to the next. There are a couple of blanks. Three or four. There. That was originally done in 1950. It's a self-portrait and a portrait of my first wife at the piano, and then the second one, me in the background. It was... in 1950, I finished the panel on this side. Never got the other one finished. And then my present wife said, that's a nice painting. I'd like to have it right here between these two windows. And it was too big to fit there. So just a few years ago, I made smaller canvases and did the two over again. This is, I just call this beach scene. It's one that one of my paintings that Hillman likes most, I think, more than any of my other paintings. This one I started when I was in Port Townsend in 1987, but it's not. About 4 by 5 feet. It's oil. This one has now been covered over. It's the first in a kind of series of carousels paintings that I did. And it's about 12 and a half feet by 5.5 feet. It's on, as you can see, maybe on two panels. This one's on three panels, and it's about, it's on two panels also. It's about the same size. I painted out the old one. This is the second one. And this is the third one, which is 15 feet wide and only 5 feet high. This is St. Anthony, The Temptation of St. Anthony, also one that I started when I was in Port Townsend. I call this one Three Ring Circus. It was really inspired when I had that first one with all circles hanging in the studio. I kept seeing figures in it, and so I worked those figures out from that. That's it.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.